matter of.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. This is episode 112 of A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig, and I am joined this week by my lovely co-hosts, Linda Cerevich. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Allison. Sorry, they changed the voice of this meeting. It's going to be recorded.
I guess Zoom updated and Linda is amused by the new voice.
I was not expecting that.
And we are also joined by Kellyanne Healy. Hello, Kellyanne.
Hello, Allison. Hello, Linda.
We're off to a rousing start, everyone.
I can't. Now she's got me giggling.
I mean, we have to do something to keep ourselves amused. There's still a lockout, everyone. There's still a lockout. So nothing's
Good
happening.
Lord.
I'm drinking beer. I'm just like, what are we going to do for this podcast? Well, the only Mets update that we have for you all is that obviously, prior to the last time we recorded, the Mets had hired Buck Showalter to be the manager. And now the entire coaching staff, at least the main coaches, have been filled out. So the bench coach is Glenn Sherlock, who was previously with the Mets. And he was also previously on Showalter's staff, both when he was managing the Yankees and when he was managing the Diamondbacks. So he's a known guy to both the Mets and Showalter. The hitting coach is Eric Chavez, who left the Yankees to come to the Mets. The pitching coach. The pitching coach is still Jeremy Hefner. He's the only one who was retained from the coaching staff. Third base coach is Joey Cora, relation of Alex Cora. He's been the Pirates' third base coach for a while, and now he's going to be the Mets' third base coach. And the first base coach is Wayne Kirby, I believe another Showalter guy. So that's the coaching staff, and that's really the updates as such as they are. There's still a lockout. The baseball put forth its proposal. So the two sides did negotiate, I put in air quotes, for the first time since the lockout began, but it was basically baseball putting forth a proposal they knew wouldn't be received well, and it wasn't received well. And that was it. There's not much happening. The union will, counter probably at some point. And we will see what the counter proposal is, and we'll see how much distance there is between what baseball and the owners are proposing and what the union is proposing.
But we are getting close to the point where spring training might be affected.
Yeah.
It's getting late early here.
Mm-hmm. We're getting close.
As Yogi Berra would say, it's getting late early out there. We're getting to the point where if this drags on much longer, spring training might be delayed. Probably, I think that the likelihood that spring training will be delayed is pretty high at this point. It's just a question of whether that results in a delay of the season, and that will depend on how long spring training is delayed. So we'll see. At this point, I had always felt there was a huge spectrum going into this lockout of what people thought the outcome was going to be. And I don't claim to know any insider info or be more informed than anybody else on this, but I have always felt that the season would be impacted in some way, not there'd be half a season or anything like that. But I've always felt that the season was the likelihood of the season starting on time was low, and it was optimistic to think that it would. But there are people on the other side of the spectrum that feel that there's too much to lose on both sides. The owners really don't want to lose another part of a season given COVID in 2020 and everything that's going on, that there's too much at stake for the two sides to not agree. It's kind of subjective where you fall on that spectrum of confidence. I still think that even as pessimistic as I am about the season starting on time, I still think that there's going to be a 162 game season. I just think it might look a little different. We might get a lot of those 7-inning doubleheaders again. There might be like a lot of, there might be like, we might be playing later into the fall by a little bit, because of a delay of at the start. Unclear
people that live in colder areas aren't gonna like that or play in colder areas.
Finally kill Jeets's Mr. November.
Right.
Oh, please.
Maybe somebody else can take the title.
One can hope. But yeah, so right now we're just waiting still, so there's not much to talk about. But for that reason, I anticipated this, that this would be, I mean, this is sort of always the, even during a normal off season, this is sort of the dead period in the off season in January when the winter meetings are already over. They didn't really happen this year because of the lockout, but the winter meetings are over, but you know, pitchers and catchers have yet to report. Most of the big free agents usually have signed at this point. So like, I already anticipated that this might be a lull in the off season, and given the lockout, it's even more so. So we decided to have a book podcast. So we all read The Captain, David Wright's memoir, which was ghostwritten by Anthony DiComo of MLB.com, Mets beat writer. And
I can't really say it's ghostwritten if he's credited.
Yeah, true. He's credited. Yeah. So he wrote, he like, you know, they collaborated, I guess.
Yes. Even though his name, his David Wright's author name is really big and Anthony DiComo's name is really small.
I feel
really
kind of bad about that because it's like, you know that DiComo like wrote it.
Yeah.
Like David Wright like gave interviews and like gave input and stuff, but DiComo probably wrote this.
Straight wrote it, yeah.
Yeah. But we all read it, and we decided to talk about it. So yeah, people had, we have some mixed feelings amongst us about this book. So I'll let, I'll let Linda go first and give her overall impression of the book.
Well, I probably should confess I didn't read the entire book.
God, how dare you?
So, like I said, don't spoil the ending. I just got to the 2015 playoff, so I hope it's a happy ending. But I'm talking to you guys about it. You did tell me it did get better, and it does. But for anybody who's considering reading this book, start on like chapter, like, I don't even know. Like after he makes his debut, after I want to say maybe like the 2013-ish chapter, like because literally nothing happens up to that point and it's god awful. like one of the worst books I've ever read. Awful. Oof. Like oof. Literally, like I was bored reading it because let's face facts, David Wright is not an interesting person. As much as I love David, you know, I was there sobbing, you know, I wrote articles for Mason Avenue, cried while writing them. My first jersey was David Wright. You know, like when I was in college, I always had to make sure I parked in parking space number 5 because that's how I knew it would be a good day. Like just completely like, you know, superstitious, but you know, it was like, I got a hit. Yay. I love the Mets. Yay. I love baseball. Yay. Like he goes into no detail about anything. And nice to probably understand. It's probably a product that his memories aren't as good from like maybe earlier in the career, like probably obviously the 2015 stuff is more recent. He's probably going to remember those more. Yeah, there's like no anecdotes. There's nothing about teammates. Like you literally find out nothing. Like there's no substance. There's no narrative. Yeah, like I would have given it 2 stars on Goodreads. I would have given it 1, but out of respect to David, I would give it 2. I'm not completely done with it, so maybe it does, you know, finally pick up. Because, you know, the rehab stuff, you're right, it did get interesting. But yeah, it's a slog, man, until you get to that point. But then, you know, you do pick up little things like, oh, yeah, that's right. Like that happened. Like, oh, yeah. But it's just like you inserting your own memories into the book. It's not him discussing it. Like, there's no setting the scene. There's no talking about the atmosphere. That you, like, you have to put yourself and your own memories in the book. Like, somebody who's not a Mets fan should not read this book because they're learning absolutely nothing.
No, I would not recommend this to a non-Mets fan.
I would not.
And I will say,
I wouldn't do it either.
I was probably the high person on this book of the three of us that I still wouldn't recommend it to someone who's not interested in this.
No, it's not content. For the lay baseball fan. Because like I said, you have to have these memories in order to, I think, like, connect with it and feel something. And
except like for me, sorry, I'm kind of like taking over.
Yeah,
like my own memories feel like very much more substantive than his.
Yeah,
like I can, and I'm coming from a fan perspective. So,
like, I could tell you a story. Like, I always sat down the third baseline to, you know, always watch right play. Like, I can tell you, like I said, I parked in parking spot number 5. He can't, I don't know if it was a product of DeComo's writing because he's not a storyteller. He is a reporter. Like, there's just no, you know, building it up and putting you there.
I think it's a combination of both.
Yeah.
Like both that he's not an interesting person and DeComo's not a storyteller.
It's interesting because going in, I didn't expect that to be a criticism that I or anyone else would have of this book of like DeComo's not the right person for this. But now I do feel that way. Because I guess I didn't think about the fact that like he's trained as a reporter and not as an like as a storyteller or novelist or anything. And so like I think that comes through here and it makes the book very shallow in part.
Yes.
But like to me, like I was talking to my dad about this recently and I was like, who convinced him that he needed to write a book? Because this could have been like, could have been like a like long form feature in The Athletic and been like actually a lot better because it would have packed in more in like a shorter. Instead, they dragged out like very shallow details across a whole book and it made it seem like very shallow, like you guys have been saying. And so I'm wondering, like, why was this a book instead of just a long form piece in The Athletic, which DeComo's obviously not a writer for The Athletic. It could have been a long form piece for MLB.com, whatever. But like that would have been much better. And DeComo would have been a good writer for that. But instead, like it's a book and he's not the right person for it, even though he probably is as close to this subject matter as anyone.
Well,
you don't get that
sense
from it.
No.
No. And he, throughout the whole book, he's like, you know, I hate being the center of the attention. I hate being the center of attention. That, like, well, then why'd you write a whole freaking
book? Why'd you write
this
book? See, I felt that way. Oh my God, I'm bringing a comparison to Jeter into this. It felt like during Jeter's final season, people were calling him like, oh, he's humble. Oh, he's great. Meantime, he's taking this like national
glorified
farewell tour, like, and with these commercials, like, I forget, was it Nike or Adidas? I forget which athletic brand.
Well, he did the Ford commercials, but I think that was before he retired.
Yeah.
No, but there was a specific like goodbye commercial from
I think it was Nike.
I think it was Nike too. I just couldn't remember if it was Nike or Adidas. Where it's just all these plays and stuff. And I want to say there was like something about humility or humbleness in that commercial, but whatever. That whole season was just very self-centered to me. And that I got that same exact feeling of ickiness reading this book.
Well, also like
he's a much more, and obviously the 750,000 athletes, baseball athletes that make it to the major leagues every year are going to have ginormous ass egos. They're going to be selfish. However, I thought there was a different layer to David that this book changed my perception on 100%. So Yeah.
To me, it's still David writing a book and just in like book form. Like, you're not getting anything of substance. He's not going to say anything bad about anybody.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like,
he's not going to trash talk.
Like, that's the thing. Is like, if you want something spicy, this is not it. If you want something spicy, this is not it. You're not going to come here for any sort of spice because it's David Wright. He's too nice, I guess.
Yeah.
To ever say anything bad about the Wilpons or like anything. Even the part because even the part where the infamous
not a superstar.
Yeah, the infamous not a superstar interview, like Wright's reaction to that is very mild. It's like he's like, he was like, I admit that it hurt my feelings a little bit, but I was like, oh my God. Come
he's
on. Like,
I know Fred, and he was just frustrated. And he even thought back to all the nice things he had done for me, like when my grandmother died and he hugged me. Come on.
But I mean, honestly though, like I think so. I originally rated this 4 on Goodreads, but I knocked it down to a 3 because I think a lot of the things that you're saying, I don't necessarily disagree with any of them. So I do think that I overrated it at first out of respect for David. but I will hold fast to my 3 because I think for me, and this just might be the way that like I rate, like how I approach like rating books or like, you know, media in general. But for me, it's like an expectations minus reality sort of thing. And like, I did not actually expect this to be all that good to begin with. So I was sort of like, this about met my expectations. 3 stars. Like 3 stars is like, this is fine. Like met my expectations, whatever. This is what I thought this was going to be. Versus a 4 would have been like exceeded expectations, and a 5 would have been like blew my expectations away, and 2 would have been below expectations, and 1 would have been way below expectations, you know? So I was like, you know, like sports biographies, they're almost all like this. Like there are ones that are not like this.
They're not that deep.
Ron Darling, complete game.
Ron Darling.
Ron Darling's was good.
Ronnie killed it. Yeah.
Ron Darling's was good, and R.A. Dickey's was good. So I think that we have like, we're spoiled a little bit in the other ones that we've read, but like there are a dime a dozen sports biographies out there that are exactly like this.
And I mean, not just sports biographies. This is like all celebrity memoirs, I think.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. In a lot of ways. I think particularly athletes have like a tendency to like put out these like platitude sort of boring like books like this that basically like read like motivational posters that are basically like pull yourself up by your bootstraps and try your best and you can make it and like things were hard but you know I worked hard at it and it turned out okay. I loved my teammates and my coaches. Like it's just very like it's very like Hallmark sports movie-esque.
I mean, even on the shallow of being nice, it was frustrating because he really didn't delve into the relationships with any of his teammates.
Exactly. No.
I mean, even Jose Reyes, he dedicated a little bit of time to that. But even that, I got the impression that they were not as good of friends as the media made them out to be.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know.
That was the impression I was left with, especially after he said, oh, I found out about Reyes signing with the Marlins online.
Yeah. And like, it's interesting because there were certain relationships that I felt like, oh, maybe in real life they were less close than it seemed, like Reyes and Piazza specifically, which Piazza, I know Linda mentions that there's very little about Mike Piazza in this book, which is interesting. But there were certain other ones that I felt were the opposite direction. I mean, I don't think he didn't delve too deeply into any of his relationships with teammates, but there were a couple that I felt like were the opposite of how the media portrayed it, particularly Matt Harvey.
Yes.
The media portrayed that relationship as very contentious, I thought, at times, like, because they have very different personalities. David Wright is, you know, the perennial leader, like never get your nose dirty, never say anything bad about anyone, like quiet, like, you know, say the right things to the media.
Not about the nightlife or anything.
Yeah, he writes in the book about how he like never went out. I'm not about that nightlife and stuff like that.
I don't know if I buy that.
I was like, oh, come on. But whatever.
Yeah, but you're a 24-year-old bachelor
especially,
in New York City.
Especially, I think there's that picture of him at the bar, like pouring drinks or something. I'm like,
Really?
Yeah, there
really?
Definitely is. At least you like he went at least once. Come on.
But like, you know, he didn't have a reputation of that.
No.
He kept his nose clean at all times, whereas Harvey, obviously, very different in that regard. It only matters to the extent that it affected the team, which happened once or twice. But other than that, it's like, you know, do whatever you want. You're a young bachelor living in New York, live the life you want to live. Sure. But like, they were very different people in that regard. And I think that the media portrayed it like, you know, at times David Bright was frustrated with Matt Harvey in the way that he conducted himself and things like that. But the book, and I don't know if that's true and Bright just glossed over it in the book because he didn't want to draw controversy or whatever, but the way he talked about Matt Harvey in this book, particularly in the section about his innings limit, hitting his innings limit in 2015, when, you know, Harvey at first was going to pull the plug on his season because he was hitting his innings limit. And he faced a lot of backlash for that because people thought that he was being selfish. The Mets were in a playoff run, but he was trying to think of his health and coming back from Tommy John surgery, and he was trying to make that decision. And David Wright does recall like a conversation that they had about it. And he goes out of his way to say, like, I know people thought that we, like, you know, had a contentious relationship, but I was actually really close with Matt Harvey and we would go golfing and like stuff like that. So I found that interesting because I think that's something I didn't know.
At the same time, I was very surprised that he did not mention anything about the 2013 All-Star Game that Harvey started.
Anything.
There was
barely.
He didn't mention Harvey started that game. Yeah,
I mean, he talked about the
talked about
that.
Playing in it.
He talked about playing in it, but there was like barely any mention. See, I didn't. I completely missed that one sentence mention.
That's like very shallow. Like Tom Seaver and Mike Piazza were there, and he mentioned zero of that.
Yeah,
The teammate that he talks about the most in this entire book is Joe McEwing, which I found
Beltran
interesting.
Too. I think Beltran
he talked about a lot. Yeah. But
Joe McEwing was the big one.
This book made me miss Joe McEwing in a way I didn't expect. I was like, oh damn, I miss Joe McEwing. He was great.
I love Super Joe, but that kind of bothered me. Like, maybe it's only me. Like, maybe it's only a sentimental fan thing that we have. Like, even when we did the Ultimate Millennium Tournament, we broke it down into brackets, and it ended up being 5-year brackets, and it ended up working out perfectly because it ended up being the Piazza era, the David Wright era, then it was like the Santana era, and then the Jacob deGrom era. So it's like, it was perfect the way that works out. And so it's like, you know, there's always that passing of the baton, like, you know, went from Piazza to Wright and then Santana, and now, you know, Jacob deGrom. And so maybe it's just us that needs that, but like, he was there for Mike Piazza's last game as a Met. And I was like, and he never mentions that. Like, you don't say like how that impressed you as a rookie to see the team was going nowhere in 2004. And yet Shea Stadium was packed to say goodbye to Mike Piazza and cheering and chanting his name and like just an endless curtain call. And he doesn't mention that only because it was like, you were there to see one of the greatest Mets of all time get a send off as a rookie, only for you to become one of the greatest Mets of all time, to get your own send-off, and you don't mention it. I was like, there's a narrative there. There's a story there. But then you spend a whole, like, 2 pages on the clubhouse saying goodbye to Joe McEwing after he was cut. I was like, so that stuck with you, but not 55,000 cheering fans for Mike Piazza?
That makes me wonder about the dynamic between them, because I sort of got the impression, and then, again, just speculation, just an impression, that Piazza obviously was in the twilight of his career, and David was in the dawn of his career. So just from Piazza's perspective, he's seeing this young superstar, potential superstar, come up, and maybe was still kind of coming to terms with his own baseball mortality. And
like David Wright was probably the annoying like golden retriever puppy that was like, yay, baseball, yay,
and I also they don't have
that's interesting.
And they don't have a whole lot in common as far as like how they came up. Like, it's very different story. Piazza was not a prospect with the pedigree that David Wright. David Wright was a first round draft pick, bonus baby, who, you know, and Piazza was like a nobody who ended up becoming a huge star beyond his station. So I think it's just very different. I don't know. I think that I think the reason why he emphasizes Joe McEwing so much is because I think that it was like, and he says this in the book, that like it was kind of the first moment that like the reality of like, oh, just because you like a guy doesn't mean he's not going to get cut or traded. Like that was like the first time that really hit him as a player because he was so new at that point. So I think that that's why that really stuck with him, is because it was like a formative moment for him to realize that like, oh yeah, that's right. Like this is a business and like guys I like get cut and traded and stuff. And I'm going to have to deal with that.
But like, it's like, but like we said, there's no talking about any of the relationships. Like even if he had a bad relationship with, tell me that. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, he's not even going to say anything bad, but like, thought there'd be maybe more of like jokester type stories
that are
pranking each other maybe, but no.
Nothing.
So, he did tell the story about the one guy
in the minors.
In the minors, but not like very little in the majors.
He talked about minor league like coach or something.
Yeah. And he talked about, he talked a lot about like playing cards with like the group of guys that he always played cards with, but that was like a different thing.
And there's a picture of it.
Yeah, there is. Yeah,
there was a picture.
But including Jason Bay, which was funny.
Yeah. But he didn't have any Pedro Martinez stories. One of the most brilliant minds to play baseball. And like Pedro was like, oh, we signed Pedro. Then Pedro got hurt.
One of the most fun guys to be around, I imagine.
To be around. Like a brilliant baseball mind. One of the best pitchers ever to play baseball. And just like you said, one of the best characters. And the only two mentions are, we signed Pedro that offseason, but then Pedro got hurt, so we didn't have him for the playoffs. And those are the only two mentions. Pedro Martinez.
See, I was going to say, we have more of a narrative of Jacob DeGrom and Pedro Martinez. Pedro Martinez's relationship.
Well, Pedro loves Jake.
Just from interviews. And DeGrom credits Martinez with turning his season around in, oh, I forget when. I forget the conversation. But yeah, we know what I'm saying. And Pedro introduced him, I think, for his first Cy Young when he was awarded it.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a public relationship where DeGrom obviously respects him and picks his mind. So there was nothing of that sort other than really Joe McEwing with Wright.
And Cliff Floyd a little bit. Cliff and Dave, I always knew were close.
Yeah, they were definitely friends for sure.
And he definitely mentions Cliff, but it's not anything like deep. It's not anything you wouldn't expect. Like, oh yeah, Cliff played pranks on him. We knew that. Like,
actually, much to Michael's chagrin, there's a lot of Michael Kadire content.
Michael Kadire!
Yeah, Kadire. Yes.
I was thinking of that, and I was like, oh, man.
I kept the whole time I was reading, I kept being like, hey, Michael, look, it's Michael Kadire. And he kept being like, leave me alone, stop it. Look, it's Michael Kadire.
We need to pull up some of those comments. Oh, those were great stories.
I was kind of bored, though, when he was going through the 2015 season. I'm like, is he just never going to mention Kadire? I was like, they signed your buddy finally and you're not even going to mention it?
Nope.
I mean, I think it'd be different if Kadire did anything.
Like, finally, I think he said, like, in his first game back, like, Kadire was there to greet him. And he's like, oh, yeah, they signed him that offseason. I'm like, after all that, Kadire became an afterthought.
No, he got so much play early in the book. And then when the Mets finally signed him, I didn't talk about it at all.
Zilch.
Yes.
It's because he didn't. Think it would have been different if Kadire had been like good on the Mets.
Good.
Yeah.
Because then he talked about how he picked him for the home run derby in 2013 and how that was a controversial like pick.
Yeah. There was more detail about that than about them being teammates. It's wild.
That's really what it is. The dynamics of this book are not, I guess, what you expected.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Which is weird. It could have been a good thing, but again, it was very shallow.
The only
it just comes off as odd.
But if he's a private person, then don't write a freaking book.
I know. That's exactly what I keep going back to. Like, who convinced him to write this book? Because I think, honestly, like, I know, Kellyanne, you were talking about, like, it comes off jittery. And I hate that because I don't think that's actually who he is. And
yeah,
like, yeah. I think that this like, almost, I can almost feel his discomfort with doing this through this,
yes,
book, through the pages of this book. Like, I can feel it emanating off of the book.
And it's like, it doesn't make for good reading.
The only anecdote that I actually like maybe chuckle, like laugh out loud was, and I don't know, Linda, this might be beyond where you got to. I can't remember, but
I think it is. Yeah.
It's toward the end of the book. It's after he needs, it must be after, because like, so he had the spinal stenosis. And then after that, so this is kind of like, there were two kind of bits in my mind that were like sort of interesting insight that delved deeper than just like, you know, this happened and this happened and this happened, which was most of the book. Yes. I thought the most interesting parts, yeah, of this book were where he got into like really his mental struggles. And there were kind of two sections where that happened. The first section is where he talks about the mental effects of getting hit in the head by Matt Cain, which was rough to read because I was there. And so that brought back a lot of like horrific memories of watching David Wright drop like a sack of potatoes and like crying because I thought he was dead.
And
not move for like a whole minute. And he said his mom cried too. And I was just like, yeah, I would cry. I cried.
If I saw my child laying prone and not moving a muscle, yeah, I'd be crying.
So he talked a lot about like the after effects of that and how it like kind of messed him up mentally for a while. But the second part, obviously, that was, you know, interesting in the same regard, was talking about, you know, the mental struggles of being injured and his rehab process from the stenosis. So he goes into the 2015 season with the stenosis, but then after that, he manages to come back, as we know, during the 2015 season, but then he eventually needs 3 surgeries in 17 months. And the first of those, I believe, was the neck surgery.
Yeah.
He needed the neck surgery, and he tells this story about like really soon after he got the neck surgery, he had to go, he was going to Citi Field, I guess, like to do his like PT rehab stuff. And and DeGrom and he often carpooled to the ballpark. And so DeGrom picked him up and he said, like, seriously, you can't drive too fast because like, I just got neck surgery. So you can't like drive too fast. And so DeGrom was going 20 miles an hour on the FDR drive. And Wright tells the story about how like cars were like beeping at him and they were beeping at him and stuff like that on the highway, not realizing that it's literally Jacob DeGrom. Like, so I thought that was pretty funny.
Even if it was Jacob DeGrom, they would still flip him off.
Oh yeah. It's New York. They definitely would. And I think Wright said that. It's like, maybe they knew it was Jacob DeGrom. Maybe they didn't, but I don't think their reaction would be any different either way. So it was pretty funny.
Places to go moving.
Yeah, 20 miles an hour on the FDR drive, good lord.
At least he listened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know, he was being safe.
Yeah, like, it's funny because like the way that Wright like describes it, or DeComo describes it through Wright, it's unclear whether like DeGrom is just like nervous and taking it super seriously, or whether he's like trolling him. Yeah. Or being a troll. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to say.
I mean, I would guess. No, Jake, speculation.
I think he was being a joke.
I think both.
Probably both.
Yeah. Like, I would say like, he probably legitimately didn't want to do anything to get David Wright hurt, but he probably took it to the extreme.
Yes.
All right. I can't drive too fast. How's this?
I'm just going to be grandma.
But yeah, I mean,
so, he didn't know what to do. That he'd have to have the right turn signal on the entire time.
Very funny. Yeah, he really. But, yeah, that really would have been it.
But just kind of going back to the start of this. Well, not the start of the stenosis. No, actually, it can be considered the start of the stenosis in 2011, where he initially was injured on that play with Lee. He said his back was fractured.
Yeah, he fractured his back.
He fractured his back and did not say anything for a month, which, I mean, kudos to him for having this attitude of trying to power through the pain.
There's a lot of that in this book.
There is a lot of bass in this book, and it made me want to like slap him upside the head. However, that's not, well, obviously that was a bugaboo, but the big bugaboo was when he said he had gotten checked up by Dr. Robert Watkins after the Lee collision. And he was, Watkins probably like gave him the all clear, I guess, or wait, let me look. I received a checkup in Los Angeles with spinal expert Dr. Robert Watkins, whom I liked and trusted enough to head back to for a second opinion 4 years later. So that first time around, Dr. Watkins didn't catch this fractured back. That concerns me a little bit.
No, yeah, I think I he know. Did, but they just thought it had healed.
I don't know.
Because, I mean, he was diagnosed with a fractured back, so somebody caught it.
Yeah. But, like, it's the like, powering through the pain, like, really, I mean, it's a theme throughout this book of, like, he takes great pride in, like, not going on the injured list in his career. Yeah. And Lindy, I think you made the note, like, it is actually remarkable looking back at how healthy he was earlier in his career. Yeah. Like, you don't appreciate that, really.
He was there, like, every day.
Because when you think about David Wright's... And we took that for granted. When you think about David Wright's career, you think about the stenosis and its premature end, but you don't think about like how he literally played like every single game before that, basically.
I think he said in, I think it was 2006, 2007, he played 160 games.
Yeah, which is wild.
Yeah.
So oof. There's a lot of him like taking pride in the fact that like he was not on the injured list and like playing through like minor injuries, but that really comes to a head like in the aftermath of the stenosis, because he like reading about how much pain he was in the aftermath of those three surgeries in 17 months was heartbreaking, honestly, because it, like, basically there were times where his wife had to tie his shoes for him because he couldn't bend over to tie his shoe. Like, and that's the point where I'm kind of like, bro, are you insane? And he like talks about how like he didn't tell the Mets how bad it was. Like he was like, oh, if I told them how bad the pain was, like I knew my career would be over. I was like, yeah, your career was over.
Like, how can you manage this?
I mean, he is insane.
Yeah, I mean,
there's no other way to say that. He in order to some kind of bananas to try and power through that and to fight that. And there's part of that you admire, that I admire, but again, there's another bigger part that's just like, man, come on,
like seriously,
face the facts, face reality.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, as an athlete, this is all he knew to have to
give that up.
And then he always said, "I always thought I would retire Matt and go out on my own terms." So it's probably hard to come to grips with that. It's not
I agree with
fairy tale ending that you're gonna get.
Yeah,
but I think it just harkens back to that original fractured back injury that kind of started all this. He said in the beginning that
the way that's it where healed, it started.
He already had a narrowing of the spine canal,
and then to heal the fractured vertebrae widens, so then that made the spine thinner than it already was.
Yeah.
So then he had to do all those exercises to like strengthen the core, so that way it would support the spine better. But it just didn't work.
Yeah. And then eventually he did have to face the music. And the last part of the book talks about setting, sort of figuring out exactly when the right moment was to have his last game. And like, I thought the most touching moment in this book was when he talks about that and like setting it up perfectly. Like, obviously he wanted to do it at home. And then he talked about how he didn't want to play his final game behind Jacob DeGrom because he didn't want to make an error in the field and hurt DeGrom's chances of winning the Cy Young, which I was like, oh my God. It's heartbreaking. Like, he knew he physically couldn't field, and he said like during his he talked about this in the chapter where he talks about his last game, about how like he was like praying that they wouldn't hit the ball to him. He was like, please don't hit the ball to me, please don't.
But
hit didn't
the ball they did feel the ground ball.
He did one grounder. Yeah, he did.
And he fielded it cleanly.
Yeah, he fielded it cleanly. Yes. He did.
I think the other fortunate thing that made that possible, that final game, was that the Mets season was lost at that point.
Yeah.
Didn't matter.
If they were, like, say, in a wild card race, that couldn't have happened.
Yeah. And he talked about that in the sense that, because obviously the Mets weren't contending anymore, but he said he specifically didn't want to play the Braves because they were contending, and he didn't want to, like, impact, like, the playoff race in any way. So he purposefully picked the Marlins because the Marlins were also not contending.
The Marlins. The but then that Marlins.
Game ended up being a very stereotypical Mets-Marlins game.
This is the game that wouldn't end.
Oh my God. And everybody was just like, come on, end. Come on.
I had to leave before the end.
No.
I will forever be mad. Well, because, okay, so, like, the only way I could go to that game, normally, you know, like, so I was in grad school still at the time at Hopkins, and I had a roommate in Baltimore, and we had a dog. And normally it almost never became a problem because we almost never would, like, go out of town on the same weekend. So it didn't matter. But this time we both were. And so, like, I had to take the dog with me because she was, I forget, like, on vacation or something. So I had to take the dog with me. So the dog was back home at my parents' house, like, in the, like, without anyone there. Like, she was home by herself. And so I couldn't leave her. Like, she had to go to the bathroom. I had to let her out. She couldn't, like, stay there that long. So I was like, because we had already had to, like, drive out there and drive back. So I was like, oh, Christ. I was like, we had to leave before it was over. Cause I was like, I can't leave the dog any longer. Like, we have to come home. Otherwise I would have been.
Well, cause I remember it was probably around, like, I want to say, like, the 12th inning. Cause I was sitting out in, like, down the left field line, like, not where it, like, turns where you're, like, in left field. Like, you're still, I was kind of, like, near where the retired numbers are, but, like, in foul territory instead of, like, where the home run territory is in the upper deck. And the people in, like in my, like, right beyond the left field wall, I remember they all just start chanting, "We want fireworks, we want fireworks." Fireworks night. And we're like, yeah, we're waiting for David Wright, we're waiting for fireworks. It's like, come on, we're never getting out of here.
Yeah, right. Ugh.
I don't even remember. And I worked that day. I'm like, I am so tired. I got there late because we hit traffic because I couldn't, like, I worked until 4 o'clock, didn't get home until, like, 5. So we left around 5, hit traffic. So I didn't get there until after his first at bat. And then, so then, my two friends, I was with my brother and my friend and her fiance at the time, who's now husband. And so he's like, well, at least we're getting our full 9 innings since we missed the first three. I was like, well, true, we got our full game in. But I'm like, I'm so tired, I just want to go home.
Linda, I feel very fortunate about every part of that game that I was at, because I was at the whole brutal thing.
I was gonna say, Linda, between the two of us, we saw the whole thing.
We did. That's true. We did.
not front row seats, but I was along the first baseline. I think I was in section 110. So I was right in front of when Peter O'Brien caught the damn foul ball, and we were all screaming, "Drop it, drop it, drop it." And then we were, like, booing him when he caught it. Ugh. But anyway, I had all these videos of Wright warming up, and I have this really cute one that I love of him. This really cute one of him kissing Olivia Shea on the cheek. I was like, and I'm, like, saying, oh, in the minute I make this, like, really inhuman weird sound. But yeah, it was a very emotional game. But by the time that game hit, I can't remember. I think it lasted how many innings?
The 13th, I think.
13th, I think.
Yeah.
Well, by the time we hit the 12th, we were getting frustrated, and we just wanted to see David Wright come out and do a speech.
That's what we were saying. Well, I don't care at this point. Just end it.
Just end it.
I don't care. Well, and then also, I remember, you said, you know, I was with my brother, and then it was the fifth inning. And I remember hearing my brother say, no, don't take him out. And I was like, what? Because I wasn't, you know, I'm just like caught up in it. And all of a sudden I see him starting to walk across the field. Yeah. I'm like, no, he's doing him not ready.
Yeah, I feel like he could have stayed in for one more at
bat. I think they wanted the symbolism of the fifth inning.
But yeah, they did.
Wright also talked about that in the book briefly, about how his initial instinct was to like fight to stay in the game, like for another at bat. But he knew that like this is like the length of time that he had prepared for. And like it takes so much to like prepare for the game. And like, you know, at that stage where he like could barely move anymore. And so like, he knew it was best to like go out that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also, can I just say, City Field is an absolute disaster at the end of the year with packed games. I'm like, how did they ever have a World Series? Like, they had no people working the concessions. There was no parking anywhere. It's like, how did they host a World Series?
Well, there was the expectation, I think, that it was a winning season. So they were in the playoffs. So, of course, they're going to be more prepared for it rather than in a losing
season.
But
you had to know this game was going to be sold out.
Yeah, but who knows?
I missed 3 full innings waiting for one hot dog. And then I get back to my seat and I just got a bun. There was no hot dog in my bun.
Oh my God. No.
Jesus. And I hadn't eaten because I went straight from work. So all I had was a little Dunkin' Donuts, like a little like bagel in the morning. So I hadn't eaten since 10 o'clock. I was so hungry. So my friend, and then I was waiting in line. And like I said, my friend was engaged at the time. And the woman in front of me was one of the consultants on Say Yes to the Dress. I was like, oh, my God, it's Christiana. So I'm like trying to sneak a picture of her. You should go to her and go get a dress.
Oh, my gosh.
That's really funny.
My friend was so drunk, too. I was like, well, at least I have entertainment while waiting on my line for just a freaking hot dog.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
The only advantage of leaving early is that we didn't sit in the traffic leaving the stadium.
There was no traffic when we left because everybody had left. Like, and they didn't want to wait around for the fight. There really wasn't a lot of people there at the end. It wasn't a full, I mean, there was still a good crowd, but it was nowhere close to like, because David Wright came out and then they played the fireworks. So I think after David left, a lot of people left there and didn't stay for the
fireworks. Because it was already late.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I have I have pictures. It wasn't. I'm like looking at the pictures. No, it wasn't full at all.
No, it didn't take long to get out at all, thankfully. That was like the one mercy of the day. I was not sitting in traffic leaving. But like, they need to do something. They gotta figure that out for when they have a big crowd, because it's an absolute nightmare trying to get in and out of there.
Well, hopefully things will improve now that there's a new owner.
I DVR'd the game and I still haven't been able to watch it. Like, I can.
When they did the Yule log this last month of his game, I was like, really? You choose that game as the Yule log?
Yeah.
Really? That you play over and over? You just want to make us sad over and over again?
Ugh. I was okay. And then, like, I was kind of getting wrapped up in the moment. Like, I was like, okay, I want to remember this. So I'm like, you know, trying to like take visual pictures in my mind. And then I heard the Captain America theme and I just screamed out, they're playing the Captain America theme, and just started stomping. I'm like, why did they do that to me? And then, that's when I lost, is when I realized it was the Captain America theme they were playing as he was walking off the field. And I still, anytime I hear Colin Cosell, I always associate his voice because he was the one who was on the PA that day.
Yeah. Ugh.
He did a good job. I even tweeted at him, like, you did a good job announcing. He was like, I was so nervous. He was like, I didn't want to screw it up.
But anyway, going back, because this turned into like all of our memories too, which our memories have more substance than this book.
Thank you.
So kind of my overall thoughts on this were just, it's very stilted writing again, going back to
there's no flaws.
Anthony DiComo is a good baseball writer. He is. He is not a great storyteller or good at memoir writing. Sorry, Anthony. I don't mean to diss you, but
you're good at MLB.com. But again, like, he works for MLB.com. Like, he doesn't do hard-hitting journalism. Like,
yeah,
he's used to writing like these, like, he wrote about the Cookie Club, which was fantastic. Like, that's like, there's
lighter pieces.
Yeah, they're lighter pieces, and there's absolutely room for those. But like, if you want like more, then you're like, that's just not his forte. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
But like, I don't know. Like, part of me kind of wonders if this was a favor to him. Like if David Wright could have chosen who would wrote it, if he like, I don't know.
Again, I agree with your assessment that this was not a book that needed to be written.
No. Like, not everybody's interesting. They're just not. Like, no, I'm not going to write a biography about myself. Nobody cares.
I disagree. I care.
Okay. Maddie will have like 5 chapters all through.
Actually, no. I was going to say, no. Actually, I don't care about you. I care about Maddie.
Okay, I'll write a book about Maddie. Madison Shea got killed, the library kitty.
Oh, I think that my I think I've decided that my end goal in this life is to live a life such that I don't ever feel the need to write a book about it.
I think that's a good conclusion to draw here.
No one wants to read my memoir, and my goal in life is for that to remain the case. if I write a memoir, guys, if in my future life, if like, you know, like 20 years down the line, if I tell one of you that I'm writing a memoir, remind me of this conversation and remind me that something has gone terribly, terribly wrong.
We'll just pull up this episode and be like, Allison, listen,
you said
at like an hour in, listen at you the 1 hour mark.
Anyway, I'm trying to like think about like what I would say to the question, like, would you recommend this book? And the answer is probably mostly no, but like if you're a Mets fan who like specifically, like, if you go into this with no expectations and you're like a diehard Mets fan, then it's probably fine. But otherwise, I wouldn't necessarily recommend.
A casual fan, you're not going to get anything.
No,
you're not going to like this. Mm-mm. It's a very boring, sanitized sports biography. Mm-hmm. And that's just what it is. Yes. It is what it is. If that's what you want, a sports biography.
You want fluff.
That's what this is. And sure, it's fine.
Because I read Ron Darling's, it wasn't the complete game. I read 19, game 7.
Or 108 stitches.
No, it was game 7.
Okay.
And he takes you in the mind of a pitcher and how what he was thinking, how he wanted to attack these guys, what they had done off him previously. So he like really took you into the chess match and like how like just how cerebral baseball is, which is perfect for Ronnie, but like I guess not everybody's Ronnie. Like he really brought you onto that pitcher's mound with him. But David Wright does not bring you into the batter's box with him. It's like, I got a hit. Well, yay!
I was gonna say, you know what, to zing David, I wonder if it's because of that lack of college education showing there as he zinged DeGrom for that. Which I know it's an inside joke, but it bothered me much.
That was mean, I thought. I know he was just trying to be funny, but I thought that was mean.
It's so mean.
For context, for those of you who haven't read this book, there's a line. There's a line in there, and this is actually toward the end, because, you know, after David Wright, like, announced to everyone that, you know, he was retiring and it was going to be his final game in September, like, obviously, like, a lot of guys, like, got him gifts and, like, gave him, like, little, like, tokens to show them how much they appreciated his leadership and stuff like that, and his friendship as teammates. And so, like, I guess, like, there was a group of them that, like, went in on a gift, and Jacob DeGrom was the one that was giving him the gift. And I guess, like, you know, Jake is not a man of many words. And so, which is the nicer way to put this than what David Wright said. Jake is not a man of many words. So like, I think he was like trying to give some sort of like, you know, emotional speech, but he tried to
make a little speech, but didn't do so well, stopping mid-sentence and shoving the gift into my hand. Here, just take this box, he'd said. Maybe it was the emotion getting to everyone, or maybe it was DeGrom's 2.0 GPA at Stetson that wasn't letting him find the right words.
I was like, aww. Dude, he just called DeGrom a dumbass. Like, yeah. That's not very nice. I was like, you didn't go to college.
I was like, I'm sure it was an inside joke or something, but in print, reading someone as an outsider to their friendship, that comes off as so mega rude.
And elitist. Like,
and that elitist, and it stuck in my cross so much.
Poor Jake.
Like, you didn't go to college.
I was going to say, I get so annoyed when people who have not gone to college, like, comment on someone else's college experience. And actually, I want to say that GPA made me think that, hey, DeGrom, I think, actually went to his classes and didn't have a tutor or anybody, like, faking his way through it and shoving up his GPA. Because that, guys, yeah. That is done. That is done, and I can
prove it.
Oh,
Ray's definitely done it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Anyway.
Ray's definitely did it.
Yeah, anyway, like.
Oh, my God.
But the point
being. I was offered to be one of those instructional people for the student athletes. And let me tell you, it's basically you're going to classes for them. It is. And you get paid $1,800 a class. At least that's what it was at the time.
Oh,
no. You couldn't pay me enough to do that stuff.
No, like, I have my own crap to deal with. I can't deal with theirs too.
No, right? And it's like, it's pretty intense too. Like,
I'm sure.
Really? I have to do all of this on top of my graduate work? No, thank you. $18. And it isn't even close to what you should be paying me for this. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. I could wax poetic on that for a while, but this is not the time nor the place. But
I know Maggie would have mentioned, she was like, imagine if Jacob DeGrom wrote a book, how boring it would be.
But Jacob DeGrom, I think, has the good sense not to write a book.
I think he's going to not.
We are never, even if like he wrote a, like, on the art of pitching, it would just be like, I don't know, just throw it.
I throw the ball, and I want to embarrass people. Point being, Ron Darling is a Yale-educated man who is now a broadcaster. So, like, not only is he, you know, is he educated and, like, you know, has a bit more of ability to tell the story, he has experience in the broadcast booth. And I think that that means a lot because he's, like, he's good at telling stories. That's part of what being in the broadcast booth is about. So, like, he's much more well suited to write a book like this than, you know, than David Wright or Anthony DeComo.
And Ron does it on both the regional in terms of SNY and the national level. So he can hook people in that aren't just part of the Mets fan base too. Like, I think the complete game is very accessible to people outside of the Mets fan base. That's my opinion on that book. I really enjoyed that book. That's probably one of my favorite sports books. Not that I've read that many. I gave that one a 5 stars on Goodreads.
And I think, like, Ron is like, and this comes through in his broadcasts too, like the way he talks about himself, you think he was like some middling, like, nobody pitcher, but he was good. He was a really good pitcher.
He had the highest BWAR on the 86 Mets. Highest. I mean, I'm going by BWAR, not FWAR. FWAR is different, but still.
Of the pitching staff, right?
Best one on the team.
Of the pitching staff, or just period?
It was overall.
Oh. Wow.
Just period.
No way.
I'm going to just double check on that, but it was period. Let me just go check.
Like, I know.
to make sure I'm not bullshitting here.
He did say, you know, it's like game 7 is really hard for him because it's hard to reconcile his personal failure with the team's success. So he was like, it's taken him a while to come to terms with it. And he was like, how do I celebrate? Like, one of my, like, the worst personal failings. But he was like, but overall, the team, you know, it was the best day for the team. And so he was very, like, you know, cerebral and talking that through and, like, talking his emotions through. And so maybe that's what also lingers, is that he failed on the biggest stage. And maybe that's just something that he never came to terms with.
Which, yeah. I mean, that's tough. Also, I was incorrect. He was third overall in 1986. He was the best pitcher. It was Keith Hernandez, Lenny Dykstra, and then Ron Darling.
I was going to say, he for him to beat out all the position players would have been something else.
It would have been impressive.
That would be huge. Yeah.
But yeah, I think going off of, he was higher than Doc Gooden.
Yeah,
which and is, like, yeah, Doc Gooden was just the talk of the town at the time. So yeah, that was what surprised me about the 86 team on that front.
Yeah.
I can see, but the next person who's writing a book, I can see it being Pete.
Oh, he would also have a boring book, I feel like, even though he would probably,
I think he would be more boring than Wright.
Yeah, well, because he's the same thing, like, yay, baseball, I love my teammates, I love my coaches, I love the home run derby.
I've played baseball my entire life, I've literally never done anything else, and it's the only thing I know how to do.
I wrote my third grade essay that I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player, and I got a bad grade. But then I became a Major League Baseball player.
Yeah, there you go. We wrote Pete Alonso's memoir.
Right there. Oh,
and
man.
I think polar bear.
I almost want to say we wrote Pete Alonso's memoir should be the title, but that kind of belies the actual subject of this podcast.
Yeah, like the 3 seconds we talked about Pete.
Yeah.
That almost kind of fits, because we found Wright's memoir kind of very unsubstantive.
But speaking of substance, we can end the show with a little more substance with walk-off wins.
Yay!
Each of us talks about something that is making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. Linda Cervich, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win was, it was my mama's birthday over the weekend.
Yay!
So my birthday was the 4th, but then we didn't celebrate until the weekend. So then we all went to my parents' house. And then this past weekend, again, we went all to my parents' house. And then my little niece and nephew were there. And Emily is on light duty. You know, that's very important. You can't turn the lights off too soon, or you can't turn back on too early. Got to make sure all the candles are out. It's a very important job. And then Danny helps blow out the candles. So again, very important job. Can't leave any candles lit. So it was just, you know, spending time with my niece and nephew is always fun. And I've convinced Emily to, God willing, to finally go to Citi Field this year. I'm like, oh, do you want to go to Mets game? She goes, yeah, that would be fun. So Woo! She wants to go, because we were going to take her in 2020 and then couldn't. And then she couldn't get vaccinated last year. So finally, hopefully, we will get Emily to a Mets game this year. But happy birthday. Nice. But the main thing is, it was my mom's birthday. Happy birthday, Mom. I hope you had a good day.
Yay! Happy birthday, Linda's mom. Happy belated birthday.
Yes, it's the 14th. Me and her are 10 days apart.
Yay!
Kellyanne Healy, what is your walk-off win for this week?
God, I don't even know. I had a really good cup of hot chocolate just now.
I mean, that's a perfectly acceptable walk-off win. It's a good one.
It is, especially it's freaking cold outside, so that's perfect.
Actually, no, my other one is that my second semester of graduate school started today. So I'm excited for that. I'm actually really excited for one of my classes. It's going to be a heavy reading semester for all of my classes, but one of the classes I'm taking is international youth literature. So we're talking about kids literature from across the globe, and I've already learned a lot, and I'm in the first week, so I'm really excited to go from module to module and learn about different countries, because we're breaking down countries every couple weeks. We're doing Spain, France, India, Japan. I think two others that I can't remember at the moment. But we're going to be talking about manga at the, in the last.
Oh, that's very module. Exciting.
So yeah, oh. there's a lot of cool literature. I'm very excited to get to read.
That's cool.
Yes.
You like have to tell you, library school does kind of take you out of your comfort zone of what you're used to
reading. It does. People like think, oh, it's this really easy degree. Oh, it's like so unnecessary to like librarianship. And it's really not. Yeah. I mean, it's a much more philosophy based degree than I expected. The information literacy it takes going like it takes to organize information, to kind of disseminate that information and make sure big time today, make sure that information is accurate and how yes. to determine if that information is accurate. There's a lot that goes into it, a lot. And people don't realize that. So yeah, I'm really excited for this semester.
Wishing you the best of luck this semester.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good luck.
My walk-off win this week is Michael and I got a new TV for our living group. So like the first week coming back from the holidays, Michael ended up having 3 snow days because it snowed like a shit ton in DC. And so what tends to happen when Michael doesn't have work and I have work is that I either get text messages from the other room or he like comes over to me and is like, see what I think would be nice for us is, and then just like shows me like a $1,500 TV. And I'm like, oh, okay. But he's been talking about wanting this upgrade for a little while now. Our old TV was like, you know, it was functional, but it was like, you know, a little bit small for the space and, you know, not a smart TV and just like, you know, like it's old and like TV technology has advanced a lot in like the 10 years since that TV has existed or whatever. So we got a new 48-inch OLED TV. And even though I would like cringed a bit at the price, not that we like couldn't afford it or anything, but I was just like, oh, this is so much money to spend on a TV. Like we fired it up for the first time. We watched something and I was like, all right, I admit this is really, really nice. And you could like tell the difference. The picture's so crisp. It's like really nice. So I'm excited about the TV. It's nice. It's a nice TV. Sometimes, you know, when you spend like all your time in the goddamn apartment, gotta have some nice things.
I was gonna say, don't mention how the Mets are gonna look on that thing.
Yeah, the Mets are gonna look great on that thing. It's true. I'm excited to watch baseball on it. Haven't really watched sports on it yet. I've only watched like random TV shows that we're watching because there's no baseball to watch.
Well, the Olympics are coming up.
That is true. I will be watching those.
Skating.
I was gonna say, I can't wait for the figure skating, the drama.
But yeah, so
and curling.
And curling. Watch some very high def curling.
Yes. Oh my god, it's so intense curling. I can't. Ugh.
Well, what happened last year was
I'm not being sarcastic about that either.
No, like what happened last year is the United States and Canada were playing for the gold medal in women's hockey. And I think that came, I can't even remember what time that came on. And then it ended up going overtime. And it was really tense. And then United States ended up winning in overtime. And it was crazy, crazy. And so then like, now I'm like pumped. Like my adrenaline's going. And I don't know, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, I can't go to bed. And then the curling finals was on. And it was the United States versus Sweden. So then I stayed up to watch the United States versus Sweden. And they won the gold medal. It was like such a great night. I was like, I can't wait to go to bed at 3 a.m. watching curling again. Because I'm such an Olympic nerd.
One of the few hockey games I watched was a men's Olympic game. I forget what year. It was USA versus Canada. And I just remember, and Linda, don't get mad at me. Don't get mad at me.
Don't say it. Don't you dare say it. I can't. I'm like gonna be like shaking in the corner and crying.
I don't remember who won that match. I just remember really
Canada.
It was Canada. Okay.
They won the gold medal in 2010 in Vancouver. And
I can't remember if it was 2010 or not. I just said I don't remember what year it was. I just
and
remember
the poor goalie was crying.
I just remember watching. I was like, man, this guy, this player is really good. And I found out it was Sidney Crosby. And I'm sorry, Linda. I think I just like made Linda really mad at me forever.
Yeah, I think they won. It was like a really heartbreaking loss too for the United States.
I feel like I feel like it was. I remember it being very dramatic. I had like zero investment, like team wise. I was just actually fascinated to watch it. I don't know what got me in the mood for it.
Yeah, well, I'm upset because of COVID. They're not letting the NHL players go this year, so I'm kind of upset about that. So we're just getting like the rookies are going to be playing the hockey. In the end, I kind of look forward to that because then I'm like, I don't know who to cheer for because then like Rangers are all on different teams. I'm like, do I cheer for Team USA or do I cheer for Russia because the bread man is on Russia? I don't know.
Cheer for the players. Just cheer for like individual players. I mean, at that point, I don't know.
But now it doesn't matter. Now I can just root for Team USA because now I got no rooting interest.
Yeah, that's true.
So go USA.
I'll say go USA because it's the Winter Olympics. If it was not the Winter Olympics, no, it's just the World Cup. I don't root for Team USA. That's right.
Well, if they make it.
No, if they make it all the way to the finals, I still wouldn't root for them. I'm sorry. No,
they don't even make it into the World Cup right now.
I'm so Team Italy. It hurts. I'm such an Azzurri fan. Even though my stupid goalkeeper just got COVID, that dumbass. Gianluigi Donnarumma, I so judge you.
Why is he not vaccinated?
I don't think so. I think half of the players are not vaccinated.
Listen.
On Team Italy.
Listen, the U.S. men are highly disappointing, but the U.S. women are amazing. So
yes, the women are like psychotically amazing.
I mean, I'm a huge U.S. women's national team fan. So
I'll root for the women's team. I won't root for the men's team.
I don't really.
So do they have like good people in the pipeline, or like are they going to continue to be good even
Oh, you best believe yes. they will continue
because like what are they gonna do like without Rapino?
I know I mean it's definitely gonna be like a new era, but like they're a powerhouse. Like they constantly are developing like top-notch talent all the time. It's like they're the Yankees. Like
I won't worry.
Stop. Yeah, no, it'll be but yeah. So that does it for the show this week. Hopefully by the next time we record in 2 weeks, there will be ending of lockouts to discuss, or like impending ending of lockouts. Please
let us hope.
Please, we don't have much more content.
Please, Robert Allen Dickey on high.
Please.
Let the lockout end.
But in the meantime, while you're waiting not so patiently for the lockout to end, you can go to amazingavenue.com. Right now, our wonderful, wonderful Miners team is running their top 25 Mets prospect lists. I think number 8 ran today. And so you can check that out at amazingavenue.com. Both Linda and I have pieces coming down the pike. Linda has a piece about why the Mets should sign Chris Bryant. I have part two of my book show, Walter Baltimore Perspective, series, hitting amazingavenue.com soon. So you should check those out. Check out the rest of our amazing pods. You can follow Amazing Avenue on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can follow this show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can follow each of us on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Linda?
At Linda Servich.
And you, Kellyanne? Oh, yeah. Kellyanne's not on Twitter anymore.
I am not on Twitter anymore. I deleted my Twitter just for mental health reasons. And you can find me, however, in the Amazing Avenue comments where I moderate.
Yes.
So come check those out. We have fun pun threads every day since we don't have anything else to talk about.
All the more reason to check out the Amazing Avenue comments, because now that's the only place online you can find Kellyanne.
Oh boy.
But you should subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. Please rate and review the show. It really helps people find it. The original intro and outro music to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets. And don't forget, there is no crying in hockey.